This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This is Otis Redding. This song, I Can't Turn You Loose, was written and first recorded by Otis Redding. It was the B-side to his 1965 single, Just One More Day. It was one of Redding's signature songs and a standard for many soul, blues, and rock performers. On this edition of The Source, we explore the short career of Otis Redding, cut short in a plane crash. Jonathan Gould is the author of the book, Otis Redding, An Unfinished Life.
With Otis, you've got to start with the voice. I mean, it's a voice for the ages, and considering that he was such a young man when he first began making records seriously in 1962, there's something almost contradictory about it, because he sounded like an old soul almost from the moment that he appeared on the scene. Otis belonged to a generation of African-American singers that I think we can now look back on and say it may have been the greatest generation of African-American singers that we've ever had. And that's saying a lot, of course, but it had to do with aspects of their upbringing, aspects of their experience, aspects of what was happening in the musical education of that generation. Otis was one of those voices. I think, not to oversimplify, because my job to some extent is to bring out the complexities of the success and talent of someone like this, but I think it begins with the voice. It was immediately compelling, the way he sounded.
Yeah, so when we talk about voice, contemporary of Otis Redding, Sam Cooke, I mean, Sam Cooke had this fantastic set of pipes and a more pure presentation of vocalization.
Darling, you send me, I know you send me, darling, you send me, honest you do, honest you do, honest you do, whoa, you.
But Otis Redding was using his voice differently, and it seemed to have harkened back to the way that you may have heard a Baptist preacher in Macon, Georgia.
Sure. Well, Otis was brought up in the church, like so many African Americans of his generation. His family was very involved with a Baptist church in Macon. His father eventually became a deacon, in Otis's childhood became a deacon in the church, and as Otis got older, his father became a preacher. So he was exposed from a very early age to the rhythms and the intensity and the whole performance style, and I use that word advisedly because I think that's what it was, of black preaching and its extension in black gospel singing. And many, I would say many singers of black singers of Otis's generation had a similar upbringing. But I think that one of the differences in Otis's case was there was not this, as there was, say, and, you know, Sam Cooke, of course, began it not just as a gospel singer, but as a gospel star. But Cooke and Jackie Wilson and many of the singers that immediately preceded Otis, who were enormously talented singers, felt some pressure to smooth out their voices, I guess is the best way to describe it. Sam Cooke's voice was so extraordinarily smooth that it was part of his appeal from the very beginning. But Otis made no effort to do that. If anything, he started out as a Little Richard imitator, singing in this very strained. I mean, everybody knows what Richard's voice was like, and it was one of the great voices of its time too. But it was a strained, kind of tumultuous voice. Little Richard also came from Macon, Georgia. He would have been one of the natural role models for Otis. And Otis started out as a Little Richard imitator. He was very skilled at it. And he wasn't singing ballads. He was singing up-tempo, ranting tunes of the sort that Richard specialized in. It was only when the time came, in Otis's case, to start singing ballads, the first important one of which was These Arms of Mine, which was his first hit, that he had to adapt that strained voice, that tumultuous voice, to a much slower tempo and a much more sort of heartfelt type of emotionality. And I think he surprised himself a little bit in the beginning at what his own voice sounded like, because he had not done that sort of material. But once he had some success with it, he did what every good singer does, which is to sort of institutionalize the sound and the timbre and the mannerisms that brought him some recognition to begin with.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about the life and the music of Otis Redding with music journalist Jonathan Gould. We're going to take a break going into Redding's first recording before his big break. This is in 1960 and Getting Hip. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're discussing the life and music of Otis Redding with Jonathan Gould, author of Otis Redding, An Unfinished Life. In 1961, Redding records Shout Bama Lama at a radio station, looking to find his path to music success.
Shout Bama Lama sounds exactly like a Little Richard record. It sounds in some ways even more like Little Richard than Little Richard. That was his first not-so-original idea about how to call attention to himself. Otis in 1962 was playing in a band called Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers, which was led by Johnny Jenkins, who was a very flamboyant guitar player. And Johnny was everything that Otis wasn't. He was sort of good-looking in a kind of sculpted, coiffed Hollywood way. Everybody in Macon described him as Hollywood handsome. He was an extremely energetic and almost acrobatic live performer, and he was a pretty good guitar player. Some people think he was a great guitar player. I have my doubts about that from anything that I've ever heard him play, but nevertheless, he was the leader of the band, and he was the focal point of the band. Otis was sort of there to provide words, because Johnny didn't sing much, to Johnny's show, and they were enormously popular on the fraternity circuit of the big southern universities, University of Georgia, University of Alabama, University of Mississippi. Now remember, this is 1962. These same universities, in many cases, were battlegrounds in the civil rights movement at exactly that that time. But while these big Southern universities were trying so hard to avoid admitting black students to their student bodies, on weekends the fraternities at these schools wanted nothing but black bands. They wanted R&B.
Kind of like the scene from Animal House.
Exactly. Johnny had quite a reputation, and the band was managed by Phil Walden, who was a young white college boy from Macon. They came out with an instrumental record called Love Twist, and it was a minor hit in the Southeast. But it was enough to attract the attention of Jerry Wexler at Atlantic Records in New York, who had established a relationship with Stax Records in Memphis. And it was enough to set up this arrangement whereby Johnny would go to Stax to record with the incomparable band, house band at Stax, which was Booker T and the MGs. They were going to make an instrumental record. And Otis, meanwhile, was going to drive Johnny to Memphis. And at some point in the session, the plan called for Joe Galkin to point out to Jim Stewart, the owner and engineer at Stax, that, well, Otis was a singer and maybe he could do something. So that was the setup. That was the plan. And it worked out better than anyone could have imagined for Otis, because Johnny, who had a very fragile ego, arrived at Stax, and he was the center of attention, obviously. He was the artist. And he ran through his material, and nobody was particularly impressed by it. And when Johnny picked up on this, he really started to go to pieces in that session. Well, this was Joe Galkin's cue to step in and say, okay, but, you know, the driver, he's a singer too, so let's give him a chance to sing. Now, as always happens in these real but seemingly apocryphal stories, a lot of other people claim credit for suggesting that Otis sing, but this was set up from the beginning. And Otis was given a chance to sing, and the first thing he sang was one of his Little Richard songs, and nobody was impressed by that because Little Richard was an anachronism in 1962. And as Jim Stewart started to get more and more fidgety and agitated at what was happening, Galkin said, well, he's got a ballad that he can sing. And Otis then proceeded to come out with These Arms of Mine.
These arms of mine, they are lonely, lonely and feeling in blue. These arms of mine, they are yearning for wanting you. And if you would let them hold you, oh, how grateful I will be. Yes, me.
Cropper, who went on to become the guitar player and songwriting collaborator with Otis, and a very important figure in his career. Cropper's statement was always that he said that when Otis began to sing this song, the hair on his arms stood on end. And indeed, it was a remarkable performance. I think a performance probably quite unlike anything that Otis had certainly recorded and possibly ever sung before. It was his last chance, in some ways, to make an impression. And one of the things that's so impressive about him at every point in his career is that he made the most of seemingly every opportunity he was ever presented with.
Now, when they asked Otis what key he wanted to sing in, what did he reply? What does that mean?
Singers usually prefer certain keys. Otis was a very unschooled musician. He played some piano. He could bang out chords on the piano, and he could bang out chords on the guitar. And on the guitar, he played in an open E tuning, which means that you just slide your finger up and down the fretboard, and you get a major chord at each fret. As a result, Otis didn't have any, or certainly many, and really any minor chords in any of the songs that he wrote, because he didn't really know how to play them on the guitar. But so most singers have keys that they prefer, and they're prepared to announce what it is. And when Steve Cropper asked Otis what key he wanted to sing this ballad he was about to come out with in, Otis said, he said, that doesn't matter. He said, just give me those church things. And Cropper was astute enough to understand that what he meant was a gospel progression in 12/8 time, which is what, you know, in musical terms, These Arms of Mine is. And so Cropper just started in, and Otis took over.
How long before that event happened and that song was released and was coming out of radios?
Well, it took a while to release it. Because there was a little bit of a legal problem. Otis, I mentioned Shout Bamalama. Otis signed a contract with Stax, which says what all contracts say, which is that you don't have any other contracts that contradict this contract or countervene this contract. And actually, Otis had signed another recording contract with another sort of fly-by-night recording label.
Yeah, but it's called Confederate Records.
Incredibly, yes, called Confederate Records, which surprisingly enough did not have a lot of success in the rhythm and blues market of the early 1960s. It was owned and run by a white man and named Bobby Smith in Macon, and Bobby claimed to be completely oblivious to the possibility. It sort of resonates a little bit with some of the controversies in our modern world, but Bobby Smith claimed to be completely oblivious to the idea that the name of this label might be offensive to the principal R&B audience of African-American men and women. The song was recorded in August. It was finally released in October, and it was not an immediate hit by any means. On the contrary, it was... It got some local airplay in Atlanta and obviously in Macon. But what really made the song was that in those days, there was the most important radio station, R&B radio station in the South, was WLAC in Nashville, which was the home of a number of actually white DJs who impersonated African-Americans on the air. They were very adept at it, and most of their listeners never suspected that they were white. And one of the most important of these DJs was a guy named John Richbourne. And Richbourne, for the small consideration of a piece of the publishing of the song, played it relentlessly all through the fall of 1962 and the winter of 1963. And gradually, it got a following.
The songs that Otis Redding continues to mint are songs that sort of duplicate the model of These Arms of Mine.
Yes, absolutely. Otis, with Stax's encouragement, Stax was not imaginative. Stax was a fledgling label that was, their impulse was, if something was successful, you do it again. Booker T of the MGs had their first big hit in the summer of 1962 with a song called Green Onions. Next record they put out that wasn't that successful was called Mo Onions, right? That's the paradigm in some ways. So in Otis's case, his initial success was as a ballad singer, and the next three or four records, maybe even a few more than that, that he put out, singles that he released, were all ballads. In the case of Pain in My Heart, it was directly stolen from a song that Alan Toussaint wrote and recorded with Irma Thomas a few months before, called Ruler of My Heart. And Otis changed a few of the words, changed almost none of the melody and the chord. And in fact, when Pain in My Heart became his first, became a more successful record than These Arms of Mine, very quickly, Jim Stewart got a call from Alan Toussaint's publishing company saying, you know, and they said, absolutely, and all future credits of Pain in My Heart are to Alan Toussaint.
Pain in my heart, it's treating me cold. Where can my baby be? Lord, no one knows. Pain in my heart just won't let me sleep. Where can my baby be? Lord, where can't she be? And now the day has began to get tough. Say they want you to come back, come back, come back, baby.
We're talking with Jonathan Gould, author of Otis Redding and Unfinished Life. Another rock read from Gould is Can't Buy Me Love, about the Beatles. More Otis Redding after this break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Restless nights, Lord, and I can't even sleep.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The song Stand By Me was written and first recorded by Ben E. King in 1961. Otis Redding gave it his treatment 3 years after it was first a hit.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we've seen. No, I won't be afraid. No, 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 I won't be afraid. Just as long, just as long as you stand by me. Now, darling, darling.
He began with this kind of begging style. All of his songs were sort of in the early going, that is to say, these ballads. They were all based on you know, the drama of the song was a man sort of almost rendered speechless by his yearning.
She tumbled in fall, fall of the mountain, may crumble to the sea. I won't cry, I won't cry. No, 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 I won't shed no tears. Just as long, just as long as you stand by me. I'm the only darling.
We're discussing the life and music of Otis Redding with Jonathan Gould, author of Otis Redding, An Unfinished Life.
Need someone to come pick me up and let you stand by me. Come on. Come on now, baby. Yeah. Man, 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 baby.
Whoa, whoa. And yearning, I think, is the main emotion. What's interesting about it, in Otis's case, and I think it's important in his case, Otis was a formidable looking man. He was tall. He was about 6'2". He was very well built. He was handsome in a distinctly, I would say, African American way. He wasn't fine featured. But he had a very, very strong features, a strong jaw, and exuded a kind of power physically. Later on, people often would compare him to the great linebacker Jim Brown, because there was something about his build and the way he held himself and so on. Well, you combine that look, the way he looked, with the sound of this man who's going to pieces. I mean, who's rendered weak by his emotional desire, and you start to understand what the sort of dynamic tension of his appeal was.
Call me Mr. Pitiful, baby, that's my name now. Oh, call me Mr. Pitiful, that's how I got my fame. But people just don't understand what make a man feel so blue. Ooh, they call me Mr. Pitiful, 'cause I lost someone just like you.
There was constant pressure on Otis to record ballads, and in early 1965, he recorded a song that is one of the songs that most people who aren't even that familiar with his career know him for, which is a song called "I've Been Loving You Too Long," parentheses to stop now. And this was a song that was actually co-written with Jerry Butler, who was a formidable recording artist of that era. Butler had written the lyrics and Otis, but hadn't finished the song, and Otis asked if he could finish it and record it, and he did. And that song is in many ways the apotheosis of Otis's ballad style.
I've been loving you too long to stop now. And you want to be free. My love is growing stronger as you become a habit to me. Ooh, I'm loving you too long. I don't want to stop now. With you, my life has been so wonderful. I can't stop now. You're tired, and your love is growing. As our affair grows old, I've been loving you, oh, too long to stop now. Oh, 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 I've been loving you. I don't want to stop now. Oh, oh, don't make me stop now. Oh, baby, no, please don't make me stop now. I love with all my heart.
On that song, all of the basic elements of what we have come to think of as the Stax sound, particularly the horn sound, were established. So it was also his first really big hit. It was a top 10, not a number one, but a top 10 R&B hit, and it did fairly well on the pop charts as well. And it was almost as if, having finally achieved that sort of quintessence of that ballad style of ballad singing, he was then free to try something else. And what he tried was his next record, which was a song that he wrote. Again, the lyrics were written by somebody else for the most part. They were written by his road manager, a fellow named Speedo Sims. But the song was Respect.
What you want, honey, you got it. And what you need, baby, you got it. All I'm asking for a little respect when I come home.
Everybody recognizes Respect as one of Aretha Franklin's great hits, and it is indeed that. But before Aretha transformed it into a feminist and perhaps even civil rights anthem, Otis had a big hit with it in 1965. And that was the first, what they called at that time, groove song. That is to say, a song with a fast, driving beat that he had real success with. And once he demonstrated that, and again, this was an extraordinary moment in his career, because he has a real hit with a ballad, and then he follows that with a real hit with a dance song, so to speak. At that point, nobody was going to tell him what to do or what not to do in terms of where he wanted to take his music.
Let's go to break, listening to how Aretha Franklin transformed the song Respect. More Otis Redding when The Source continues. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In 1963, Sam Cooke and his family were refused rooms at a Holiday Inn in Shreveport, Louisiana. That inspired him to write the song, Change Is Gonna Come.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Jonathan Gould is the author of Otis Redding, An Unfinished Life.
It's been too hard living.
Sam Cooke died at the end of 1964 in a sort of absurd and tragic shooting involving the owner of a motel. And Otis had always idolized Sam Cooke. But in the early going, Sam was such a formidable singer that Otis did not have the technique, and he did not have the range to really act on that idolization that he had. By 1965, though, by the summer of 1965, he was feeling more confident about himself. But for Otis Blue, he recorded three of Sam's songs on that, kind of as a tribute almost to Cooke. People are angry at me a little bit in the book for being somewhat critical of Otis's version of A Change Is Going to Come, because as he was prone to do, he forgot the words in it while he was recording it. And in normal circumstances, if a singer forgets the words in a recording studio, which they do all the time, they stop the tape, they go back, and they do it again. But there was something so powerful, emotionally powerful, about Otis's performance that they just sort of powered their way through this thing. And it is an extraordinary performance. It would be an even better performance if he had managed to bring out some of the nuances in the lyric that Cook wrote into the song. And in some ways, the song that I like of Sam Cooke's that I think Otis far exceeded Sam Cooke's version, which is in his rendition of Chain Gang.
That's the sound of the men, they're working under.
Sam Cooke wrote Chain Gang when he was touring the South. From the seat of a car, he saw a Georgia chain gang by the side of the road and was moved by the sight of that and wrote this song.
I hear something saying.
The sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying.
Otis, on the other hand, was much closer to the world in which Georgia chain gangs operated than Sam ever was. And in fact, when Otis sings the song, he puts himself in the position of the men on the chain gang. It's an incredibly powerful and subtle interpretation of a song which is otherwise kind of almost sociological.
Man, I'm going home.
we get to the Monterey Pop Festival, Otis Redding makes his appearance. He stole the show out of all these amazing acts that were there. It seemed like an oddity that he was there at all.
Well, it was. And this is where his career starts to take the high point of the detour that his career started to take. Now, Otis, I mentioned, had a white manager, Phil Walden. Phil and Otis were aware of this young white audience. After all, that's what Phil was doing there. He was a young white Southerner who had his life turned around by black music. And since that was Otis's management, I think that both of them were much more open to the idea of actively courting this new audience that had been brought into being largely by the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan. And so when the opportunity arose at the end of 1966, Bill Graham, who was running the Fillmore in San Francisco, when he approached Phil Walden about having Otis play there, they said yes. People just had never seen anything quite this intense. He had a period of imposed convalescence. He had a throat operation. He had to have a throat operation. He had to have polyps removed from his vocal cords. And after this operation, he was told that he couldn't sing at all for 6 weeks. And so he went back to his home in Georgia. He used that time to write a whole spate of new songs. For the first time in his professional career, he was really applying his talent and his attention to writing lyrics. He had always felt that lyrics were something that you could take or leave, essentially, that the important thing was how you put them across, not what they actually said, not the meaning of the lyrics. The crown jewel of that new material, of course, is the song that he's best known for, which is Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships rolling, then I'll watch them roll away again. I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, and I headed for the Frisco Bay. 'Cause I've got nothing to live for, look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay.
He had done pining ballads, he had done groove songs. what he hadn't done was a song that was introspective with shades of overt autobiography in it. And this was a whole new type of writing that he did.
Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything seems to stay the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Sitting here resting my bones in this long.
Before Sitting on the Dock of the Bay was released, Otis Redding died in a plane crash. The plane went down in bad weather near Madison, Wisconsin on December 10, 1967. Otis Redding was 26 years old. Jonathan Gould is the author of Otis Redding, An Unfinished Life. This is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies.
Sitting on the dock of the bay, I'm wasting time.